This is Focus 580, hour number two of our program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. The producers for the program, Harriet Williamson, Martha Dale, Kyle Mabry, is at the controls this morning. We are here weekday mornings from 10 until noon. We have 10 different topics every week. You can take a look at the schedule so you'll know about upcoming programs by going to our website. That way you can also hear programs that you might have missed last time they were broadcast. Some you might want to hear again. That's there on our web archive. You can sign up for podcasts. It's all at WILL.illinois.edu. That's WILL.illinois.edu. By the end of this year, the United States will have spent nearly $50 billion defending against bioterrorism. The question we'll take up this morning is, has this money been well spent? Our guest for the program is William Clark. He is Professor Emeritus of Immunology at the University of California, Los Angeles. And we'll be talking about some of what you will find in his book. The title is Bracing for Armageddon, The Science and Politics of Bioterrorism in America. It's published by the Oxford University Press. In this book, he looks at some attempted incidents of bioterrorism, why it is they were not successful, and argues that while it is true that a bioterrorist attack could happen, a more serious threat, and one certainly we need to prepare for, would be something that would be natural, a natural pandemic, for example, like that outbreak of influenza that killed millions of people around the world back in the year 1918. We'll be talking this morning in this hour of the show with Professor Clark, and of course questions are welcome from people who are listening. The only thing that we ask of callers is that people are brief, just so we can keep moving and get in as many people as possible. But of course, questions are welcome. 333-9455 here in Champaign-Urbana. We do also have a toll-free line that's good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. So at any point, questions are certainly welcome. Professor Clark, hello.
Good morning, David. Happy to be with you.
Well, thanks very much for talking with us. We appreciate it. Just we'll try to discuss this topic in some detail, but just as a way of starting out, let me ask you just flat out, do you think that our concerns about the possibility of bioterrorism are exaggerated?
Yes, I think that's it's very clear that this has proceeded way beyond any realistic expectation that national or subnational or transnational groups could actually create a bioweapon and make it work, make it function, and use it to cause mass casualties in the United States. I think the likelihood of that is extremely slim.
And is that because the level of technological expertise needed to create it is rare, or is it that, in fact, biological weapons by their nature have limitations that make them actually not very good weapons?
Well, it's actually both of the above. I mean, one of the things that drew my attention to this whole question of a bioterrorist threat is, having been a scientist all of my life working in a laboratory, I can tell you that biological organisms are very difficult to work with. It takes an enormous amount of expertise in a wide range of disciplines. It's not enough just to be a microbiologist, but you would have to have biochemists, you'd have to have bioengineers, people who can create a weapons delivery system. It's one thing to put some anthrax spores in a letter and mail it around. It's another to create a weapon that you can spread over a large area, affecting a lot of people. You know, our own military gave up on these kinds of weapons. In fact, really never used them. And they had the best scientists in the country, people at Fort Detrick, creating these weapons for them, and they just chose not to use them because they're too difficult to use. Mm-hmm. But certainly it's... making them is an enormously complicated chore, and then converting them once you have a pathogen that's in a reasonable form to use, creating a delivery system is a whole other level of complication which people don't often appreciate. You have problems of weather, these things, you know, which way the wind is blowing, how much sun is out there on a given day, which can practically neutralize some of these agents. So it's very complicated, yes.
Hmm. And then just to pick up on the other point that I touched on briefly in my introduction, though, I'm sure that you would argue that there is the significant possibility that there could be an outbreak of infectious disease that would be very serious, could make a lot of people sick, people could die, and certainly that is the kind of thing that we should be prepared for.
Well, I think that's absolutely right. I mean, a bioterrorist attack, is even by those who staunchly defend the possibility, recognize it as something of high impact but low probability. But on the other hand, a natural pandemic is basically a slam dunk. I mean, we know historically that two or three natural pandemics arise every century. Of course, the one you mentioned in 1918, which killed probably at least 50 million people, if not 100 million people worldwide, is a reality. And I must say that until this present moment, we cannot trace a single death in the world to bioterrorism. Now, we can talk about the postal anthrax attacks, which killed five people, but it's not clear that that was, in fact, bioterrorism. We, to this day, don't know who did it, and we don't know what that person or person's motives were. And so whether we can even justify calling that bioterrorism is not clear.
Mm-hmm. And that's, I suppose, it would be fair to say that that was a criminal act involving a biological agent. But you would say that's a little bit different from the kind of thing that we'd be talking about if we were using a term like bioterrorism.
Absolutely. And you know, this notion of a biocrime is something that we have to be clear about, because one of the things that led to the great, one of many things that led to the great hysteria about bioterrorism was a list that was compiled of alleged bioterrorist incidents around the world. And in fact, when you look at that list very carefully, the vast majority of them are biocrimes, people using biological weapons for ends that have nothing to do with classical terrorism, you know, which is the furtherance of a political or a social or a religious end. So, in fact, we're spending $6-8 billion a year on something which so far we can't trace a single human death to with unambiguously. And at the same time, as you probably know, seasonal influenza in the United States kills 40 million people a year. Mm-hmm. And so there's a great disjunct between the threat of the actual verifiable threat of bioterrorism and the level of our response to it.
Just very quickly, again, to introduce our guest, William Clark is professor and chair emeritus of immunology at the University of California, Los Angeles. He's the author of the book Bracing for Armageddon, The Science and Politics of Bioterrorism in America. The book is published by the Oxford University Press and takes a look at this question. Just how likely is it that we would have a bioterrorist attack here in the United States? If it is indeed likely at all, is that something that we should prepare for? How should we prepare for it? How should we think about that possibility? And questions, again, are welcome. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Certainly the government is a way of trying to analyze the threat and how it is we might respond to it has conducted a number of exercises. In fact, in the book you write about one of them that took place this was before 9/11, so perhaps we weren't quite as tuned into the idea of some kind of massive terrorist attack as we were after that. But this was something that the agent here in question was smallpox, and this was something called Dark Winter. Tell us about Dark Winter.
Well, Dark Winter is one of a number of these kinds of exercises carried out by there's a number of agencies involved. There's a center at Johns Hopkins University that puts some of these together, and others as well, in which a hypothetical scenario, in this case it was the release of smallpox virus in three locations simultaneously in the United States, and, you know, certainly a possible scenario. And then the way these things are run is that some government officials that might be involved in the response to such an incident are gathered together in a room and are fed information, hypothetical information that's coming out of this scenario, and asked how would they respond to it. Now, of course, almost hardly any of our government officials are biologists or microbiologists or biochemists or anything like that. And they really didn't know how to respond to this. They didn't know what the lines of communication that were open to them might be, what sorts of resources they might mobilize. And frankly, it just scared the devil out of these government officials. And a number of these scenarios were run, and it created enormous anxiety and uncertainty, understandably, of course, among these government officials. And that was... made it very easy to sell them on the idea that we needed to spend, you know, billions of dollars a year to prepare ourselves to defend against this. Now, admittedly, some of the things that have come out of this have prepared us to deal with natural pandemics. But in fact, a natural pandemic is quite a different thing from a bioterrorist attack. A bioterrorist attack is local. Pandemic would spread around the country. The way we would have to respond to a natural pandemic is really quite different from a bioterrorist attack. But they become mushed together, and I think of it as the tail wagging the dog. The real threat that we need to prepare ourselves for in the years ahead is how would we respond to a natural pandemic. The preparation to deal with a natural pandemic would also prepare us to deal better with a bioterrorist attack. But I think we don't want to prepare ourselves for a bioterrorist attack and hope that it covers us for a pandemic. We want to do it the other way around. So that's one of the problems we face. But there was a whole industry of putting on these scenarios. I think there's probably a dozen of them all together, and they created an enormous amount of anxiety among government officials and led to this massive throwing of dollars at a problem which isn't the one that we should be addressing.
Yeah. Well, certainly in recent years, we become aware that there are a number of emergent infectious diseases, whether they were something new or whether they existed, and yet they existed in isolated pockets, and something about modern life makes them more easily transmittable. Things like SARS and the avian flu, and of course we have a lot of other things. We have HIV, and we have tuberculosis, and a wide range of things.
Yeah.
And of course now we're getting to be a little bit more concerned about foodborne illness as well, which is maybe not quite as bad, but you know, we obviously, with the idea that we don't want people dying from eating tomatoes because they're contaminated with salmonella. So I mean, that's the kind of thing that's it's worth thinking about and trying to deal with. But I guess the question is it in fact easier to get people excited and energized and thinking seriously about this if you're talking about bioterrorism than if you're talking about something like avian flu?
Well, I think it's incumbent on our government and our health sector officials to chime in here and point out what the realities are. I mean, again, the reality is that not a single person has ever died of a bioterrorist attack. Again, I have to put the five people who died in the postal anthrax attacks on hold until we find out what really was at play there. But our government officials need to help educate people to the fact and stop using the sort of hysterical threat of some mysterious foreign agents attacking us with these horrible weapons that we know so little about and can't defend ourselves against. So I think there's a role for the government to be played in education as well as proceeding in a rational way to defend us against natural pandemics and coincidentally bioterrorist attacks. Hmm.
We have a caller, and we will talk with him right now. Here's someone who's listening in, calling from Champaign. This is line number one. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Yes. I'm very sorry I haven't had a chance to read your book, but I have ordered it. And just one correction. Actually, there is a law, the Biological Weapons Anti-Terrorism Act of 1989, that was passed unanimously by both houses of Congress, signed by President Bush, and I drafted that law. I fully agree with your assessment of what is really going on, the scaremongering in the name of bioterrorism. The truth of the matter is, in my opinion, if you go back and read, and I have it in my book, Biowarfare and Terrorism, if you go back and read the original PNAC document, Project for a New American Century, they have called for the development of offensive biological weapons. And they moved in with the Bush administration. And I think, personally, that's really what's going on here with why the $50 billion is there. It's to develop offensive biological weapons under the guise of dual-use research. For example, the Spanish flu virus that you mentioned that they have unearthed and brought back to life,
yes.
That was being funded by the Department of Defense.
Mm-hmm.
So your comments, please, on that. Thank you.
Yes. Well, there's great concern. I think it, and I'm sure you're aware of this. It goes well beyond that. There's a new institute which is being created to anticipate and study possible bioweapons that might be used against us in the future. And there is great concern that how do you work on these kinds of putative theoretical biological weapons and how to defend against them without actually creating them to study. And there's enormous concern among many segments of society that just the very creation and the creation of such weapons in order to study them poses a very real threat. I mean, there was a hoof and mouth disease outbreak in Britain a year or so ago, which clearly was traced to the escape of a hoof and mouth organism from a laboratory. And so the creation of biological weapons may not have stopped. It may, in violation of the Bioweapons Convention that we signed, as I'm sure you're aware, many years ago, it may be that we are continuing to this day to create new bioweapons. And for what purpose? You can't possibly imagine every biological weapon that might be created that could be used against us through genetic engineering and so forth. The number would be infinite, and there's great question about why this institute is being created, at what level is going to be funded, and really what its purpose is. So I know I agree with you completely about the dangers of engaging in this kind of thing.
Mm. Well, you certainly touch on a point that a lot of people have raised, and that is the current level of technology might indeed give us the power to produce something that would be very dangerous, very deadly, perhaps work better in the military sense than what we've had in the past. You talked earlier about the fact that at least in the past, the United States, the defense establishment had abandoned the idea of bioweapons because there were too many problems with them. They didn't work that well. Now it seems that what you're saying, though, is that in response to this question, is research going on now? What I hear you saying is, well, nobody really knows whether it is or not.
Well, we know that the money has been appropriated to set up this laboratory. It's somewhere near Fort Detrick. It's obviously being kept under wraps. But it's publicly known that such a facility exists, and people are really questioning what is the point of this, and also are we creating weapons in contravention again to the treaties that we've signed, forswearing any creation of bioweapons in the United States. So no, it's a potential problem. How well this works, whether they're going to be able to recruit the kind of scientists that they would need to recruit to actually do this sort of work, perhaps remains to be seen. But our military really doesn't want to use bioweapons, and from a terrorist point of view, you have to really wonder. Is it worth it? I mean, again, they're enormously complicated to make. I doubt that they can be made, even though former Senator Daschle still thinks that's the case. And if they could be made and could be delivered, what is really the level of threat here that we're talking about? And very few people are convinced although some obviously are, that it's really a serious threat.
Well, there's certainly one, and when you look at recent terrorist events, biological and chemical, there was at least one group that had some level of technological expertise and had resources to put behind doing this, and that was the Aum Shinrikyo make a successful attack. This was using a chemical weapon, but they apparently also were working on biological weapons. You'd think, well, if of all the recent groups who are trying to do this, who might have been able to pull it off, given the fact that you do need a high level of technical expertise, and you need a lab, you need the infrastructure to develop and so forth. You think, well, if anybody could have done it, they could have done it, and they weren't successful. But does that though give you the faith that someone else couldn't come along who had that kind of money, who could attract people with that kind of expertise, who might actually be able to do it?
You know, in an infinite world, anything is possible. Yeah. But if there's anything to be read from the Aum Shinrikyo incident, it's that. I mean, they put tens of millions of dollars, built state-of-the-art laboratories, recruited MD and PhD level scientists to work in their facilities, and they were simply not able to produce one of these weapons. And but our government actually used this and completely misinterpreted, from my point of view, this incident, and turned it around and said, this is what could happen. Well, in fact, nothing happened. After 2 or 3 years of utter frustration, they turned to sarin gas, which was extremely easy to use, released in a subway, and although it didn't kill that many people, it certainly had the potential to. So, I something passed across my desk here recently. Tom Daschle was saying that progress in molecular biology and in the pharmaceutical industry has eliminated most technical barriers to the construction and use of bioweapons. That's just simply not true. The difficulties of creating one of these weapons remains. From a terrorist point of view, a bomb or an airplane or a chemical weapon is going to be so much easier to use, is going to get so much more quickly the kind of results that a terrorist wants to see. So to spend tens of millions of dollars, months and if not years of time, in trying to get one of these uncooperative biological pathogens into a form that you can use as a weapon, just wouldn't make any sense to a terrorist organization.
We're at our midpoint here. Our guest is William Clark. He's professor and chair emeritus of immunology at University of California, Los Angeles. He's written extensively on topics in science and medicine for the general public. He's the author of the book Bracing for Armageddon, The Science and Politics of Bioterrorism in America. It's published by the Oxford University Press. And questions are welcome. We have someone we'll get right to. The number, if you're here in Champaign-Urbana where we are, 333-9455. We do also have a toll free line, and that'd be good anywhere you would hear us. If you're listening over the air around Illinois and Indiana or across the country on the internet, it's 800-222-9455. We have someone next up in DeKalb, and that's line 4. Hello.
Yeah, good morning. You know, I don't know if you guys remember the movie Andromeda Strain. It's kind of bringing back visions of this. I can't understand why we have to go this route. I would think you would want to develop things that would be, you know, anti-biological, try to, you know, stop the things from happening. But, you know, we all know out there, I think pretty much a lot of us have this idea that there's like in a government within a government, like a black ops type thing, because there's things that get developed all of a sudden within 10, 20 years, it's these things start popping out and showing themselves. My concern is that we keep building more weapons. I mean, don't we have enough things now to blow this planet up 10 times over? I mean, I don't understand it. Are we that far out of whack in this country and out of touch? I just don't understand it. I mean, if you look at the way the American public feels about war in general, you know, I would think we'd be in a defensive mode, not an offensive mode. Am I wrong?
Well, I think the government response was viewed by politicians who were acting in perfectly good faith as a defensive mode. Unquestionably, the state of public health preparedness in this country for any kind of a biological catastrophe, natural or otherwise, had fallen to an unacceptable level. And one of the things that did happen that was a positive thing from this bioterrorism scare has been that that in general, public health preparedness has been improved considerably. Communications. I've talked to our local bioterrorism people here, and they're very skeptical of many of the things that the money has been spent on, but they are appreciative of the fact that there's much better communication between federal and state and local agencies and between states and so on and so forth. So some of the money has been used for useful things. But yes, I mean, continuing to produce more and more weapons and then trying to prepare, as we were talking a few minutes ago, about preparing defenses against weapons that haven't even been created, trying to imagine what they might be, perhaps setting them up, creating them in the laboratory so you can study them, just gets off into, I don't know, some kind of space age fantasies. So your point is well taken. I think we've done enough along those lines, and we need to deal with more sensible threats.
All right, let's talk with someone in the nearby community of Belgium, line number one. Hello.
Yes, hello.
Mm-hmm.
This is kind of frivolous, but I just had to say two words, ICE-9.
ICE-9.
Yeah, you know the Kervonnegut book?
No, I don't, actually.
It's something that comes out of one of his novels. That's Cat's Cradle, and uh-huh. it's about a doomsday a weapon.
Uh-huh.
Something that, if I remember right, when it's released in the environment, it turns all liquid water into ice.
Right, right. Yes.
Yes.
Okay,
well.
Okay.
Well, what it's I suppose what that suggests is that we have imagined such things for a long time and have thought about that potential and about how dangerously wrong such a thing can go, you know, to the point where in the case of that novel, obviously that means the end of life on Earth if all liquid water suddenly becomes ice.
Yeah, if it was ever used, that would be the end of the planet.
And I suppose that, you know, it does raise questions about, the kind of things that we're talking about once deployed, how controllable are they? Or is that, in fact, at least to this point, would you say that there's nothing that has that kind of potential to get so out of control that it would get away from the people who deployed it and end up biting them in the behind.
Yeah. Well, I think here in our discussion this morning, we're really focusing on biological agents turned into weapons, and so something that would turn all water to ice, of course, is something you would have no defense against. Certainly, we do have both biologically within ourselves, our immune systems, for example, we do have some level of defense against these kinds of things. And I don't think that there's any bioterrorism weapon that is even perhaps on the drawing boards of these guys playing around in Fort Detrick that has the potential of wiping out the entire human race. That's not likely. You know, HIV may come as close to that as anything. I mean, the real nightmare scenario is that HIV could mutate into a form that can be spread by sneezing in an elevator, and with a 10-year, anywhere between a 6 and a 10-year latent period before the full-blown disease develops, the potential for spread of that would be enormous. And so we have, putting bioterrorism aside, we have natural pathogens in the world today that are much, much scarier than anything that anybody could come up with on a drawing board for a biological weapon.
Yeah. Well, again, I want to thank the caller. Others are welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. Just for a moment, I'm interested in having you talk some more about the anthrax events of 2001. And again, going back to a little bit of our earlier conversation, there may be some question about whether you want to label that bioterrorism or biocrime.
We just don't know because we don't know what the
intent of the individual who was responsible, if indeed there was one, or who knows how many. And I guess that's the question I'm interested in. Even after all this time, we really still don't know who it was that was responsible for this?
We don't. There was an individual, his name is Stephen Hatfill, who has been a long time a suspect in this case, and in many ways, just by the nature of his personality and his past history, is an attractive candidate. But it's not been possible to unambiguously tie him to this crime. And so, we just don't know. Terrorism has to have some overriding political or religious or social aim. In case of bioterrorism, we're talking about using a biological weapon to achieve some such goal, as opposed to just a personal ego thing. You know, the Unabomber or Timothy McVeigh or people who have much more limited goals, which are not often very well spelled out. Or the Rajneeshis up in Oregon spreading salmonella around salad bars in Oregon. We just don't know. We just don't know if the postal anthrax attacks were terrorism or just some strange fantasy played out in somebody's mind with no really overriding political or other motives.
Let's talk with someone else here in Champaign. This is line number two. Hello.
Yes. Well, again, I do want to commend you for an outstanding presentation today, but one slight point on the last comment. About a month ago, Fox News did publicly report that the FBI has narrowed the search for the anthrax terrorist culprits to four or five very high-level scientists working at the Department of Defense's own Fort Detrick, Maryland.
Yes.
And I think all the evidence, certainly, that I have been able to accumulate tends to indicate that it was people working at Fort Detrick, Maryland, who were responsible for this anthrax.
Yeah.
In fact, the day they published the Daschle technology in the New York Times, I called a very high-level FBI official dealing with counterterrorism, whom I knew, Marion Spike Bowman, to tell him that, in my opinion, the only people and facilities that would have the capability to do this were run by the United States government, and that Fort Detrick would be at the very top of my list.
Yes, I think everybody agrees that this was not done by somebody in their garage, not done by people sitting in a cave in Afghanistan. The quality of the at least of some of the anthrax spores, the ones that were sent to Daschle and Leahy, the quality of those spores was such that it's clear that this had to be somebody working. Possibly in a university laboratory, although that's extremely doubtful, but very likely somebody working at Fort Detrick. Hatfill had some connections with Fort Detrick. Others are on the list as well, as you point out. Yes, this is not a foreign terrorist group that did the anthrax attacks in 2001. That clearly was a very highly skilled scientist with access to the kind of either access to a finished a spore product or certainly with the capacity and the resources to create it. So I agree with you. Yes, it certainly was a U.S. scientist that did that. Probably, one could say, very, very probably working at Fort Detrick.
And it gets back to the other point, then, that I regret to say I think someone working for the United States government, this gets back to the previous caller about a secret government, probably has a stockpile of super weapons-grade anthrax that they could deliver again.
Well, Fort Detrick certainly, as far as we know, has plenty of that. Of that. I'm not certain at all that there's any kind of a plot within government or within Fort Detrick to do anything, with this material. But it certainly does exist, and its very existence, some would point out, is in itself a threat. Whether we should destroy it, as we have done with some of our nuclear warheads, that's another question. But anyway, yes, the government clearly is involved with these kinds of weapons or potential weapons, and it's there and it's a danger.
Thank you.
Well, thank you for the call. We have about 15 minutes left in this part of Focus 580. Again, our guest is William Clark. He is professor and chair emeritus of immunology at the University of California, Los Angeles, and is the author of the recent book Bracing for Armageddon, The Science and Politics of Bioterrorism in America. It's published by the Oxford University Press.
I would just point out title, Bracing for Armageddon, has a question mark after.
Oh, yes. Perhaps I should have noted that.
I must say, when I first started out to write this book, having read some of these scenarios like Dark Winter, I thought this might potentially be a real threat. And mm-hmm. My skepticism grew as I went along with the book, and by the end of it, I put that question mark in the title. Are we bracing ourselves for Armageddon, or is this something else at foot here? Anyway, so there is a question.
That is absolutely correct, and I think I want to make sure that people understand that sort of the basic argument the book makes is that while it is possible that there we could have a bioterrorist attack here in the United States. It is not, however, very likely. And again, as we've talked, there is the real possibility that we could have a serious outbreak of infectious disease, and that is something that certainly we ought to be aware of and be prepared for. And in fact, there may be some parallels between what you would do in both cases. But as our guest has explained, he would argue that the one is much more likely than the other. So questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. Well, having said that, I suppose that I could ask you just to talk a little bit about that, and that is our state of preparedness to deal with a significant outbreak of infectious disease.
Yeah, well, we now do have it's about a year and a half old now, we do have a national plan for dealing with a natural pandemic in this country. There was an initial contribution of $6 billion. This was about 2 years ago. I don't have those figures in front of me, very, very little, if anything, has been added to that since that time. I think that many of the people in the government that were so concerned about this bioterrorist threat are gradually moving over and realizing that the real threat comes not from a human inspired outbreak of one of these pathogens, but by just this natural immigration into our society. I mean, the avian H5N1 influenza virus is. Has the potential, at least, for an enormous devastation if it ever first of all mutates to a form that passes readily into human beings. And that, at the present time, the H5N1 influenza virus variant does get into humans, but it not very readily. And also would need to get into humans in a form that's readily spread as seasonal influenza virus is from person to person. Should that happen, I mean, the potential of that is just is staggering. The 1918 flu that you alluded to at the beginning of the program killed about 3% of people who became infected. By comparison, seasonal flu that kills some 40,000 people a year in this country kills about somewhere around a tenth of 1% of people that are infected, and mostly old, very old or very young people. The 1918 influenza variant killed about 3% of its of infected people, and interestingly, it tended to kill people more in their middle years than at the very young and the very old. The H5N1 virus, the avian flu virus, the latest figures on that are something like 383 people now worldwide have been infected by H5N1. And of those, 241 have died. That's a 60% mortality rate. Now, if you can imagine something spreading around like seasonal flu, which is an influenza virus, not that terribly different from H5N1. It also arose in birds somewhere in China. With a 60% fatality rate, that's just staggering. That's staggering. We've not seen one death from bioterrorism, and here we're talking about something that has the potential to kill tens, if not hundreds of millions of people worldwide, in this country and worldwide. The social and economic and every other implication of that is just staggering. And yet we're doing almost nothing. Well, I shouldn't say that, because we are starting to move in that direction. And certainly our local, you know, I find that our local and state and county people are much more attuned to the dangers of these natural pandemics than our government officials are, our federal government officials are. So, you know, that's something to be really, really worried about. And so I'd like to see our government take a more active role in educating people about the dangers of these natural pandemics, and especially something like avian influenza.
All right, let's talk with some of the callers. Champagne next, line number one. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
I have some high-level friends that insist they know the government is using chemical procedures to manipulate the weather and cause tornadoes and things. Can you comment on that?
Well, that's pretty far out of my area of expertise, I must say. I'm not a meteorologist, and I can only say that I don't have any information about that. I'm sorry.
All right, let's go on to another caller. This is Champaign County and line number two. Hello.
Yeah, it's called our energy policy, putting carbon dioxide in the air. But I wanted to know if you would like to speculate about the motivations. We just had this scenario about Fort Detrick being the source of this. It reminds me that it might be good to point out, it's not germane particularly to your subject, but that Judith Miller, who was the conduit from the White Vice President's office, was beating the drum that the anthrax was from Iraq. So, it seems to me that
it clearly wasn't. Iraq never had, as far as we know, never had a weapon.
They did. We sold it to them, probably, because we did sell them the chemicals too.
Well, it's possible. Yeah.
Yeah. So it's part of the drumbeat, it seems to me, and governing by fear, that seems to be ubiquitous. But
yeah, war. It's a war on terrorism, and you know that sort of gets people's blood boiling. If you frame something and sometimes it works out well. I mean, Nixon's war on cancer was, that was great. I mean,
actually, I don't think so. I think it put us on the wrong model, actually.
Well, yes, but sometimes that's how you motivate people. I mean,
but still, if public health and getting chemicals out of the environment had gone ahead, I think we'd have less of a cancer rate than if people were trying to figure out how the body identifies what's self and what's not self or something like that. So, and that's actually chimes in quite well with my corollary, which is if people take your advice, then they say, well, we must beef up public health, we must spend it on hospitals, we must spend it on procedures, methodologies for networking. That doesn't dump money into biotech industry. So I see this as part of military Keynesianism, only it's not helping the airplane manufacturers. It's helping kind of jumpstart the biotech, and people have an infinite capacity to to mislead themselves and delude themselves, according to Scott McCullen. That's what he thought that Bush was doing. But
sure.
You know, they think they're doing what's right for the country, but it just happens to fit into their stock portfolio.
Well, you know, I've worked all my life as a scientist at UCLA, and some of our guys got together and created a company called Amgen out here in Thousand.
Oh, I heard it.
Yeah. They made a lot of money doing that. The thing is that scientists sit in their laboratories and create all kinds of wonderful possibilities, but they don't really have the ability to translate that into something that can really be used for whatever end. On a larger national scale, and we do need the private sector. You know, universities can't produce drugs. They can't produce medicines. They can't produce.
Sure,
except
they have, and they turned it over to the private sector. Actually,
sorry,
the antivirals, retrovirus. I mean, a lot of stuff has been developed in academia and in the National Institute for Health, and then it gets privatized. And the people that make the money on it are the people that didn't do the research.
Yeah, well, that's true, but I don't know how to get around that because you really do need the private sector to take an idea and put it on a large scale that's going to affect the lives of a lot of people in a positive way. So you know, it's unfortunate in some ways, but I mean, one thing that I mean, the possibility of profit is a tremendous motivating force, and it gets things done that just wouldn't be done by guys like me sitting in laboratories with great ideas. But
it's things many of which that oughtn't to be done. But
Anyway,
I agree. Yeah. You know, we need initiative and need private enterprise, but I don't see that we've had that. What we have is the government captured by corporations and then dumping money into the things that they want to study anyway.
Well, that's cherry picking in the last 8 years has become an art that can only be admired. But that's what we have.
All right, let's take at least one more caller in here. It's somebody in Champaign. This is line number one. Hello.
Hello. Yeah, I just wanted to answer that previous point about the speculation over the anthrax attacks. In fact, both Senator Leahy and Senator Daschle were holding up the passage of the USA Patriot Act, the first draft of which would have suspended the writ of habeas corpus and turned our country into a police state.
Yes.
And then all of a sudden, they both got hit with super weapons-grade anthrax, and the Patriot Act was passed, though fortunately some staffers stripped the suspension of writ of habeas corpus, except for aliens, that was put in there. Then a similar scenario happened on the renewal of the USA Patriot Act. It had a sunset provision. The renewal was up. Senator Feingold was holding it up, and all of a sudden there was an anthrax scare at one of the Senate office buildings, and it passed the next day. So
yes.
I think what we are seeing here, you know, is a coordinated effort by elements within the United States government, CIA, DOD, to, you know, create a police state and to use this stockpile of super weapons-grade anthrax precisely for that purpose. And in my opinion, if we don't find who these people are, they will strike again because they have this stockpile. Your comments, please.
Yeah. Well, what can I say? The anthrax is there. We have the example of one person who had access to it and used it in a frightening way. And it's impossible to say, you know, but it could happen again. But what I think is not going to happen is that somebody's going to take those anthrax spores, put them in a form that can be dispersed over a wide territory and kill tens, if not hundreds of thousands of people. That's just not going to happen. On the other hand, that person could take anthrax spores and put them in 10,000 envelopes instead of a dozen or so, and send them around the country and create enormous havoc. That's possible, yes. And we do have to find out who did it, and we have to find out how they did it, and we have to try to make sure that it doesn't happen again. Absolutely.
We're just at about the point where we have to finish. Maybe we have a minute or so left. Maybe just ask you one other question, and that is how adequate is the system that we have that would, if we're talking about, again, the danger of a naturally occurring outbreak of infectious disease, how adequate is the system that we have to try to monitor for that so that once such a thing happened, we would actually know it was happening, we would be able to identify what it was, we'd know where the hot spots were so that we could then respond?
Well, that's again one of the positive things that have come out of this bioterrorism preparedness thing is that there is a network now run by National Institutes of Health and CDC where biological incidents that are suspect on the local level are immediately forwarded to a computer system, an alert goes up, and then they start sending out feelers. Are you experiencing this here? Are you experiencing this there? I would think we would know very quickly, certainly within 24 to 48 hours of an initial outbreak, whether or not we're dealing with a pandemic. And there a lot of thought has been put into this. You know, how would we respond? I feel that is one of the positive things that has come out of this preparedness thing.
All right. Well, there we're going to have to finish up with, again, the suggestion that if you'd like to read more on the subject, you look for the book Bracing for Armageddon. That's the title with a question mark. The subtitle is The Science and Politics of Bioterrorism in America. It's published by the Oxford University Press by our guest, William Clark. He is professor and chair emeritus of immunology at University of California, Los Angeles. Professor Clark, thank you very much.
Well, it's been a pleasure talking with you.